We got a book here I think you'll find of interest. It's called Game Life. It's Michael Klune's kind of memoir as a gamer. And it's of particular interest to me because, you know, gamers are omnipresent now. They're everywhere you turn. And I never, I was too born too late to be a gamer, you know. Pac-Man in bars is not being a gamer. So, but Michael Klune actually at age 7 had an epiphany involving games. And he sort of became, he's got sucked into the game of life, the game life of life. We'll let him talk about it right now. He's with us from Cleveland, Michael Klune. How are you, Michael?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. This was this is really an eye-opener to me. I actually learned something from reading a book.
Thank you. Kind of amazing.
Because I really am sort of baffled by the whole gaming phenomenon. You know, I was born at a strange conjunction where it didn't quite happen yet. But you, it was important in your life.
Yeah. You know, I'm 40 years old. So I'm the first generation that grew up playing games, basically. Mm-hmm. And, it basically shaped the way I see the world in some strange ways from the age of 6 onwards.
Yeah. Was there a particular epiphany at 6 or around there that changed your world?
Yeah, it was the first game I played, which is one of these old text-based adventures. It came out in 81. Called Suspended. And in the game, it was the first time I'd ever thought about death, strangely.
Yeah.
I died in the game, and it sort of taught me something about death, which is that it doesn't matter that much. Because I pressed a button and I was alive again.
Yeah. Well, that's not really accurate. I believe if you do die, you can't push a button and start over again.
Well, we'll see.
Now, was it something about you or about something, the fact that games were now available? I mean, there's something about you, even before there were these games and so forth, that must have found this so appealing.
Yeah. I think that's right. You know, I was sort of, I'd moved from Ireland at a fairly young age to the U.S., and I felt sort of out of place in the world.
Yeah.
And games, I felt, gave me a way of relating to the world that felt comfortable. It sort of gave me a way to be alone that didn't feel as isolating as I felt sometimes around my friends who had these strange accents and, you know, strange concerns. And so I think that was part of what drew me in at an early age.
Yeah. Doesn't it also tend to alienate you from friends, though? Because it's pretty much an individual experience, gaming, isn't it?
It is, yes, yeah. It's a way of exploring your solitude is one way I've thought about it. Although in the book, as I talk about, you know, part of it is being alone and being away from people, but it was also a space in which I worked out strategies that I could use in navigating social life, the perilous social life of middle school, in all kinds of ways. So it kind of played a dual role for me in terms of social life.
Yeah. So destroying objects became useful in real life?
Oh, yes. Yes, very much.
Victory at all costs and avoiding error. Are these the lessons that to be learned?
Yeah, well, there were some of the lessons. The strangest lesson I probably learned was from a game called Pirates, which I decided would be a really good model of how to get friends in middle school. was to try to set up a pirate operation in our Catholic school, and it ended up not going so well. But I did actually make some friends through it, so it was a victory.
Yeah. And speaking of Catholic, your mother was, when she found your Dungeons and Dragons, was appalled that you were doing this.
Yeah, she was, and you know, at that time there was this hysteria. The two big hysterias of my childhood years, one was, child molestation. Everyone was afraid of that. And the other one was Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
And and I don't know how they're related. I hope they're not related. But I got into Dungeons and Dragons, and my mom was, like, deeply appalled. You know, this was some kind of evil thing. And as I thought about it, you know, I sort of thought, as an adult, thinking back on this, I kind of thought she was kind of right. You know, there is something about
evil.
There's something strange about those games that has to do with their use of numbers. Everything becomes numerical in those games. It was the addition of numbers to fantasy.
Yeah.
And it gave fantasy this real weight that that it didn't have otherwise, and made it more attractive and more have a more of a gravitational pull.
Yeah, and your father is implicated in this, right? Because in church, that thing with the numbers in church was rather unusual.
Yeah. That was you know, my dad. You know, we used to go to church every Sunday, and he had this idea that what would help my memory was that if I memorized all the hymn numbers that they had posted up at the front, and at the end he would quiz me on what there's six or seven different numbers of the hymn book.
Yeah.
And if I remembered it, I would get some money, and I used that money to buy Dungeons and Dragons games.
Yeah. And it was helpful that those sort of memory and number skills actually were crucial for your gaming adventures.
Yeah, it was, you know, I guess one of the big breakthroughs of gaming that happened in the 80s and continues today was everything became statistics. You would have a character and they would have certain kinds of numbers associated with them in terms of whether they could perform certain actions. And this sort of numeralization of this fantasy world, it was a major thing. And being a writer, someone who's always been drawn to words, mm-hmm. numbers were always very alien to me. And so as I learned to manipulate them, they always felt, you know, they had this resistance that fascinated and repelled me.
Yeah. And of course, anything computers, it is all numbers, basically, right? It's all the code and so forth.
Yeah, underneath everything, underneath all the images we see and everything, as we know, it is, it's code, right? It's not words. It's not English language or any human language words. It's a machine code. And so there's something unsettling about that. And games kind of give you a relationship to those numbers that underlie so much of our lives now that I became very interested in.
And was this something that you did not get from Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yes. I write about, you know, I thought the biggest mistake of educators' relationship to games was they thought they would make games that taught you things, right? And of course, that is a recipe for really producing really boring games. So in this book, I really tried to go the opposite direction, is look at the games that were really fun to me and try to see if there was some insight I could gain by thinking about how and why they were fun.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, Dungeons and Dragons. I taught high school for a while, many years ago, alternative high school. So there was some of the students had actually taken over the janitor's room. I don't know where I think they threw out the janitor, too. And it became the Dungeons and Dragons room. And there's a group, and they were all really nice kids. I liked them and stuff, but they would not tell us what was going on in that room there. But it was Dungeons and Dragons, and I didn't understand it, and it seemed very, not scary exactly, but a world that I was not allowed into. And just to look at Dungeons and Dragons for a moment, isn't that sort of the archetype for a lot of these sort of mythical adventures? And what was it about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're totally right. It really was the archetype. And part of what was so fascinating about it was this thing that kids could get into that the adult world had absolutely no clue what it was about. Right. And my own experience was somewhat strange because I could never get any – none of my friends wanted to play Dungeons & Dragons. They thought it was like for nerds, you know. And so I was always trying to get people to play with me, and I couldn't. So when they first had the first computer game that you could play a Dungeons & Dragons game on the computer – that completely turned me on, and I was able to access this underworld through the computer. But the groups of kids who would be playing this, like in with actual other people, they always were this sort of they seemed like a mix between a cult and like a punk band or something in my school. and I was always fascinated by them. But yeah, absolutely, that was the beginning of everything, I think.
Yeah, but what was it about, I know the fact that adults could not access it, but there's something about the gameplay itself and what you could achieve and and the defeats you had to overcome. What was it about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And my own thought is part of it is it's this fusion of fantasy. Just, you know, if you look at it just as the kinds of things people are doing in Dungeons & Dragons, they're killing dragons, they've got swords, they're living in this fantasy medieval world, sort of like J.R.R. Tolkien. But what made it completely different was you added dice. All of a sudden, everything that you had to do, every decision you made, every task you had to complete had these numbers involved. And you had huge books full of statistics, hit points, which is how many points you had until you got killed. Everything had numbers. And the addition of those numbers to this fantasy gave it this sense of reality and a solidity to it, where you felt like you're not just doing something make-believe, but you're doing something that has its own logic, its own rules that are sort of outside the normal world, but have a real kind of weight to it. So it didn't feel like make-believe. It felt like you were really entering this other world. And I think the role of the dice and the numbers had a really major role in making that happen.
And then once the computer got involved, it was either computer-generated random numbers?
Yeah, the computer took over the role of you'd press a button and it would roll these roll the dice basically using a random number generator.
Yeah.
And and that's sort of what made it work.
Yeah. And what's interesting too, when you think about it, religious texts going way back, have a lot of them have numerological associations with the in the text itself. So there is a whole. The numbers were involved from the very beginning in some of this kind of important business.
Absolutely, yeah, that's a really great point. Yeah, I mean, you go back to Pythagoras, the ancient Greek mathematician who had this very a belief of the mystical significance of numbers. And as you say, you see that in many religious traditions, certainly Judeo-Christian traditions, where the significance of various numbers, the significance of dates, page numbers, verse numbers. It does have this kind of strange mystical significance that gives us a sense that we're looking at a reality beyond the visible reality.
Yeah. So you were back, and it was 2D. Everything was 2D. So you're working on a flat map for your games. And then, of course, it went to 3D. But you think something was lost when things went 3D.
Yeah, I really do. And now a lot of people are talking about this Oculus Rift headset where you can sort of put it on and just be immersed in this be in it. To me, that ruins a lot of the magic of games, which is what makes games really appealing is that they're different from reality and that you've got what we call a fourth wall. Like when you're watching a play or a movie, part of what makes it appealing is that there's that distance between where you are in the audience and what's happening on the screen. And when you erase that, I feel like a lot of the magic, a lot of the sense that there's this other world gets collapsed. And so when I've talked with game designers recently, one of the things that I've been interested in is people are beginning to understand that. And if you think about Minecraft, which many people, which is probably the most popular computer game of all time, its graphics are very, unrealistic and primitive looking. Mm-hmm. And people love that because it gives you a sense that it's not like the real world. It is this other kind of world.
Yeah.
It's
sort of like a hieroglyphic you're working with.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But the difference between two-dimensionality and 3D itself is something that you find to be pretty an important difference.
Yeah, there was, a lot of the early games were basically maps. You would have a bird's eye view of this world. And I have this very vivid memory that I write about in the book where I was playing this map-based game. I was at my friend's house. He dropped me off. His father dropped me off, and I was walking along the. It was snowy out, and I was looking at the ground. The ground was covered with snow, and it had this kind of bluish radiance under the streetlights, and it looked sort of like a computer screen. And I began imagining that the ground underneath me was a map, and that the little icicles and twigs and footprints all had were cities and rivers and so forth. And I just dawdled along looking at this at the surface of the world in this new way until the police had to come get me because my mom was worried. I was out there for like 3 hours.
And when they came to get you, what did you say to them? What were you doing?
I just said I was just – they were like, what were you – they asked me, what were you doing? And were you dawdling? And I used the word that they gave me. I said, yes, I was dawdling.
Dawdling, yeah. You don't hear much about dawdling anymore. And it's a shame, too, because you had something you could do, so you're dawdling. Putting off doing anything is dawdling. That's a good thing.
Well, nowadays, if like kids are like, kids are walking around by themselves, like, the cops come for the parents, it's like they don't really have that opportunity anymore.
Yeah. And they should take the parents away. That's what I mean. Now, if we come to the present, though, do you still game? Are you still a gamer?
I do. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I. Yeah.
What do you do now? I'm kind of curious.
Well, I play. You know, there's been a lot of. One thing I'll say that people often ask me is. There's different kinds of games out there, and there's one kind of game that I don't play, which is what's called massive online multiplayer games.
Yeah.
And I don't play that.
Is that too social for you?
In a way, it's like sort of the worst part of social life because it's and it also has this addictive quality that I try to stay away from. So I play, you know, games that have, you know, the primitive kinds of graphics, the top-down kinds of graphics, games like Civilization, these kinds of things. And I play for like a couple hours, you know, 1 or 2 hours, 3 or 4 days a week. And yeah, I still love it. I stopped the book at the end of middle school, but I certainly, you know, still do enjoy playing games. And I think that they're, you know, they're a real art form.
Yeah. But when now today, when you come down to these games that are largely, you know, the shooter games and the mass shooter game, you know, it seems to be a variety of different ways you can shoot people and and destroy things. Right, and because the graphics are so real, it's the photographic realism of what you're doing. Does that, in your opinion, would that have? It's not the kind of thing that you would play, but does that have an effect at all on the player as to what is acceptable in actual life or not? That's a big question.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a question lots of people talk about. But I'll give you a little anecdote that was really interesting to me. In the New York Review of Books, this guy wrote a review of my book, and he talked about the person who was responsible for the Sandy Hook shooting.
Yeah.
Who the media reported at the time that individual who committed that horrific crime was really into shooter games. Mm-hmm. But what this writer did was he looked into this guy's background, and he found that the game that he was obsessed with, the game that he played the most, is a game called Dance Dance Revolution. Mm-hmm. And you know, and he would obsessively play this. So to me, that suggests that the link between individuals' inner lives and the games they play isn't as simplistic as we might imagine. In other words, so I think there's a lot going on there. And I think that just as, you know, 100 years ago, people would worry about the kinds of novels people would be reading, today we have the same fears about games. And I think I don't think there's a simple answer. In other words, I don't believe that just because someone likes to play shooting games, they're going to go shoot people, or just because people play Dance Revolution, they're going to go shoot people. I think there's a kind of
or worse, they're going to go out and dance. That would be the worst possible outcome. it might have been the connection actually was some kind of motor skills, you know, for this guy.
or some kind of obsessive. Yeah, who knows? I was just very fascinated by that, and kind of want to know more. Yeah.
Yeah. You never did any Dance Dance Revolution in the early stages of when they were.
No, I've never. Yeah,
there's
no,
a dance map you could follow.
I play games because I want to get away from dancing.
Yeah. Okay. Did your mother, by the way, ever come to accept the fact that you were a gamer, or was that a tough, impossible sell?
You know, she did. One of the nice things was she really liked the book, which I was sort of nervous about. I was wondering how my mom would react to the book, but she really loved it. And you know, really one of the things about this book is I wrote it not intending to write it about games. I wrote it as a way of trying to write about my childhood. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult for me to recapture the texture of my childhood. But by going to these games, which I had these vivid memories of, that I found were interwoven with scenes and relationships in my childhood, I was able to tell that story. So, and I think that's what she appreciated in the book. I think she's still ambivalent about games, but she did like the story. I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, and that interplay in the book, I think, is what's most fascinating about it, is because you're learning in games something that you didn't know you could do in life. Even if there's not a direct application for some, you know, for going out and getting a sword that can kill better than the one you had before, but yeah, like the whole thing about victory and defeat and how to, I mean, for a kid now, is there actually a way you can apply just those sorts of things to your life, or is it more just a sense of more self confidence in yourself?
Well, yeah, that's a really interesting question. There's this big movement now called gamification, where people want to take their businesses and add gaming elements into the workplace to try to make workers more engaged. You know, I think that's just a terrible idea.
Yeah.
You know, to me, the magic is that games, like literature, which is what I'm fundamentally interested in, is outside of reality, and it enables us to discover things that aren't necessarily one-to-one applications. So the map idea is an example I often use. Playing those map-based games, they gave me a new way to look at the surface of the world and to appreciate elements that I would ordinarily not even think twice about, like snowy lawns under street lamps.
Yeah.
It's those kinds of unexpected resonances that I find fascinating.
Yeah. And don't you think, like, for many kids, they have skills and qualities that are completely undervalued in the real world?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and I think that's more so. I mean, as a literature professor, I feel that is really true. We are so focused on this testing regime and on very narrow sense of what skills are will lead to employment. That when you actually talk to employers, often what they say is, you know, we want someone who's not, you know, who's going to be able to learn future skills, who's going to have those capacities to communicate and to think and to imagine. And I feel too often those qualities are sort of left on the cutting room floor because they don't fit into our metrics.
Yeah. I certainly felt those kids I was talking about in Dungeons and Dragons, they were all really smart kids, you know. So I figured it couldn't be that bad, whatever they're doing in the janitor's old room, you know.
Yeah.
They're super smart. So it was interesting. It was interesting. Well, you know, the book is great. It's called Game Life. Michael W. Kloon is the author. And Michael, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Michael Kloon, ladies and gentlemen. He's a gamer.